And good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're very pleased to have, again, here on the show, to talk about things that grow in the home landscape, Sandy Mason. She's with us once a month on the program. And it's a nice thing to be talking about here is that we are in the clutches of old man winter, thinking about the fact that it's really only about 2 weeks until the first day of climatological spring, which would be March 1st, and I'm sure that there are a lot of folks who are already thinking about what they would like to plant in their gardens in the coming year. So throughout the year, we do these shows to give folks a chance to ask questions, get advice. And so Sandy is joining us this morning on, because of the weather, she's joining us this morning by telephone. Also joining us this morning as a special guest is Janet McConovich. She's a garden designer and writer, and she will be a special guest at the Garden Day for 2007. And this is only about 2 weeks away, March 2nd and 3rd at the Holiday Inn in Urbana, sponsored by U of I Extension and the Champaign County Master Gardeners. And we'll give Sandy a chance to talk a little bit more about that here. And it is the opportunity for people to call in and ask questions. And maybe you have some kind of problem from last growing season that you still have to solve, or you are thinking about what you'd like to plant. Maybe you would like some suggestions on particular varieties, or anything else that has to do with things that grow in the home landscape. You give us a call, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, Sandy, are you there? Good. And what a slacker. All it takes to keep you away is just a little blizzard. I mean, come. Come on. All right. Well, I'm very glad that you're with us, no matter whether it's on the phone or whether you're here. And joining us by telephone, Janet McConovich. Janet, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thanks very much.
We're looking at your snow coming our way, and very glad, actually, to have it. And I figure if it's going to be winter, I'd like it to be winter and look like winter out here.
Well, this is the most – it's been years here where we live since we've had a snow like this. It's been – last couple of weeks, it's been quite cold, so it's a little shocking. But it does kind of come with this season. You really can't – what can you do, you know? You try to make the best of it. And Sandy's laughing because she's thinking he's being positive. I can't believe it.
It's so rare for you, David.
Yes, it's true. It is rare. But in any case, we have one caller here that's ready to go. And Sandy, maybe just for a minute, you want to talk about the Garden Day just to start us off?
Yeah, sure. And as you said, spring is not too far away. Maybe hard to believe, but we're going to have our Garden Day. It's actually Friday, March 2nd and Saturday, March 3rd at the Holiday Inn in Urbana, so easy access off of Interstate 74. And we got a great lineup of speakers. Actually, Janet's going to be with us all afternoon on Friday, so people get a chance to do kind of a hands-on program, and maybe she can talk a little bit more about what's going to happen there. But then on Saturday, we have Janet as well as three other speakers that are going to be speaking about everything from Janet's going to be talking about kind of adapting the best from what you see around town, kind of some landscape design. A person that also works with her, Pam Palachek, is going to be talking about some things with garden color. We are always interested in that from, you know, start to finish, how do you get that color? We also have Stephanie Cohen, who's a well-known author and speaker, and she's going to be talking about foliage plants, kind of the dark and light side of foliage. We have all these bright, fancy plants now with all this great foliage, but how do you use them effectively in your garden? And we also have Roy Diblick, who's with Northwind Perennial Farm, and he's going to be talking more about kind of native plants, good combinations with native plants, and how to use some plants that are really tough in your garden. And so we're really excited about this program, a great lineup of speakers, and I think the one of the great things this year is that people can actually register online, which is something that's been a little bit different for us, and they can just go to our website, and it's very easy. You don't have to put in www at all. It's just champaign.extension.uauc.edu. So great program, and you can sign up for either both days or one day or the other, so
okay.
I hope people can join us for that.
Well, maybe I should say a little bit more about Janet, and then she can talk maybe for a minute about what she's thinking is going to happen with her appearance at the Garden Day. She's been involved in designing and planting and maintaining gardens now for more than 20 years. She's an advanced master gardener. She has authored 6 books. She started in 1984 her own garden and landscape design firm called Perennial Favorites. She's written a column that has appeared in the Detroit News and now is available through Practical Gardening Institute, and she also writes a column for the Michigan Gardener magazine. Is that pretty good, Janet?
Some days it feels like it's pretty good. And some days I think, wow, you just can't ever keep up and you can't do enough. It's where do you go to the middle? I am really glad to be participating in this, Sandy. Again, it is such an exciting group of people to get all those gardeners wanting to talk about ideas and looking for ideas all together in one place at a time when you're just on that edge of going into spring is an energizing thing for everybody involved. And for me, it's a great chance to get more ideas and to look at how my ideas are working in more places. So I'm always glad to do that. And then when it snows, I write about it. That's really what you have to do is you have to say, I can't garden right now. I don't live in Georgia where I can kind of go out and cut my roses at this time of year. I have to sit and think about what I'm going to do and then jump out there and do it as soon as I get the chance. And the landscape, our workshop on Friday afternoon before the main conference on Saturday, we are going to be looking at one of the things that I find hardest for people to do in the years that I've been helping them designing in their yards and also teaching them classes and writing about it, is that if you look out this time of year, to even imagine that shrub that's outside your yard, your window with leaves on it is hard to do, let alone to imagine changing something to where you don't have that tree right there or you do have a tree in this other place. So we're going to be looking at ways that you can strip away all the visual distractions, even at this time of year, and use some simple processes to visualize what's there as a foundation and how it will look if you draw some new lines through the landscape that are lines for your eye or lines for your feet with nice, interesting stops along the way. It makes it a little easier to figure what you're going to do before we get that 1, 2, 3, okay, get set, go. Now it's April and May. We can get out there and plant. And that's always just totally energizing to do.
All right. Well, we have a couple of callers here. Let's see what's on their minds. They're both in Urbana. The first is line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. This is very nice to participate in this. My wife and I are both scientists at the university, and we use our garden as therapy, actually. And one thing we've noticed, we use the same 20 by 20 plot for our vegetable garden. We live in the old part of Urbana, so, you know, the topsoil seems to be 6 feet. But last year we had a peculiar event. We plant a lot of tomatoes for canning and stuff like that. But last year, all of the varieties had very thin stems. We rototill the garden every year. We mulch our leaves in the garden, things like that. But really, this was probably one of the poor performances we've had. What should we do so we don't have a repeat? We were kind of mystified by how bad this repeatedly used garden was. So I think we've been using the same plot for almost 30 years now. So I'd be very happy.
Did you say that the tomatoes had thin stems?
They were very. I grow the tomatoes from seeds, and so they have a lot of good genetic resistance to different diseases. But all the three varieties—an early girl, a Roma, and a big boy, or better boy—all had very, very thin stems. All the varieties did, and the plants were not very productive at all.
I wonder whether your pollination wasn't real good. Did you have the same wet and gray early part of the summer that we did before it got to that heat? Because one of the things that thickens the stems on any fruit, whether it's a vegetable in your tomato or whether it's a seed pod, is seed production. Is the actual seeds themselves are producing chemicals, call them plant hormones or regulators, mm-hmm. that cause the stem to thicken. And it might be that your pollination wasn't real good last year.
I'm talking about the stem going into the ground.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Then that's something that light has more to do with that than anything early in the year, doesn't it, Sandy?
Yeah, and I would really wonder, being in Urbana, there's a lot of big trees. Does it get full sun?
Yes, it does. That's why we keep the garden in the same place. We have an area that gets full sun all day.
Okay, and have you fertilized this area at all? Have you ever put compost?
We put in a large, like 5 cubic feet of peat moss into it, and then we use the chemical fertilizer like Miracle-Gro or something like that periodically.
You know, you might want to start out with soil tests. That might be way to go, because I really wonder, you know, depending on what you've been doing and how long you've been growing things. And you know, compost is actually a really great thing to sort of certainly improve the structure of the soil, but also, you know, just for the fertility, just to sort of help it out, too, besides just using peat moss and then just regular commercial-grade fertilizer.
Okay.
So you may want to think about more of that kind of thing, sort of changing the soil.
I've been using the output of our compost bins for flower pots and stuff like that, but maybe we should divert all that stuff into the garden.
Yeah, I'd sure be thinking about that if you haven't been adding compost on a regular basis. But before you do that this season, when you can finally get out there, I'd definitely get a soil test, kind of see what's going on.
Where do I get soil tests from?
Actually, you know, locally, you can. There's actually one on North Mattis called ASM Labs,
mm-hmm.
and it's way out on North Mattis. But you can, or just check on the Yellow Pages. There's a couple different places. I think there's one in Monticello as well, and Illini FS Farmtown, I think, also takes in soil samples. So just check in the Yellow Pages, but there's a couple places in town, and it's usually a pretty nominal fee, you know, $8 or something
mm-hmm.
like that, so pretty inexpensive, and it's a good place to start.
When does one take a soil test?
Well, usually when usually fall is is a better time, but as soon as you can get out there and the soil isn't frozen or horribly wet or anything like that, but usually you can do that early spring, even before you start getting stuff out there.
Great.
Do you start your tomatoes from seeds indoors,
yes,
then, and
I
then
do.
Move them out?
Yes.
Do you beat them up a little bit when you're growing them?
Well,
it does sound bad, but you know there is truth to the technique of shaking the bench, that you can actually develop stronger stems early on if the plants are exposed to some stresses. I mean, there are growers that literally have the benches that their seedlings are growing on vibrate several times a day. It's one thing to try doing. Maybe you were especially nice to them.
I baby my plants.
And you might also even think, like, even just a small fan sometimes, to put the fan on.
Yes,
They shake, too. Sometimes that's kind of a nice thing, too. But, yeah, that's a good point, too. Maybe just making sure that they're hardened up before they go outside might help.
Great. Thank you so very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let me just quickly introduce again our guests, and then we'll go on to another caller here. We're talking with Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Once a month, she is here on the program, usually here in the studio with us, to talk about lawn and garden care and to answer questions about things that grow in the home landscape. Also, as a special guest, also joining us by telephone, is gardening writer Janet McConovich, and she will be here in Champaign-Urbana as one of the guest speakers for the Garden Day 2007, coming up March 2nd and 3rd. She's the author of 6 books, has written a column for the Detroit News, and then that same one is now available through the Practical Gardening Institute, and they do have a website, and I'm here looking at it right now. So if you're interested in that, you can go there. And there's her picture right here. I'm scrolling down, and there she is. You can read Janet's weekly tip. So that would also be one way to tap into her expertise, and of course you can also head down to the bookstore and look for some of her books. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, and that's line 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm going to have some remodeling done on my house, and the wall that's going to be extended, there's a lilac bush that has grown there every year. And I'm trying to figure out if it's possible to just transplant the lilac bush or whether I should just let it go and just buy a whole new plant and start over again.
How big is it? How tall is it?
Well, I trimmed it back last year. I trimmed the lilac bush back last year. And so it's about 4 feet tall. It didn't bloom last year, which is why I'm wondering if it's even worth it to try and save it.
Well, it may be worth saving it, but I laughed because one of the first things that I moved at the house where we are now, we've been there about 30 years, but when we first moved in, I looked around and went, okay, you've got to go, and you've got to go, and you've got to move there, and I informed my husband that we were moving that lilac shrub, and ever since then, he has told me if I ever make him move a lilac with me again, that we won't have another 30 years together, because they do have... The older plants have a pretty massive root system, and if yours didn't grow well after you cut it back, is it possible that it's in the shade of a tree and you're also going to be dealing with its roots tangled with tree roots?
No, it's right on the corner of the house. It's the northwest corner of the house, and so there's nothing else around it but just just this bush. In fact, I have noticed when I mow that it's pretty entangled, the roots and stuff. So when the guys do the remodeling, it's going to be a heck of a job just getting that plant out of the ground, I think.
Yeah, you can spend a whole day digging it out. But meanwhile, you can get a newer, improved hybrid lilac of a particular kind and get it started in a good place elsewhere, and it will, for what, $25-$30 rather than spending the whole day. It is a lot of work to move an older, bigger shrub.
Right.
And unless there's a real good sentimental attachment to it, and even then you can just take a piece of it. You can take a start of it. It's probably not worth it. You're going to have a lot to do with the remodeling as it is.
Yeah, as it is, right. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, well, thanks for the call. And let us continue here. And I think the next person is also in Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Good morning. I like to think of myself as a tough-hearted gardener, but I have a rabbit sitting on the windowsill out of the snow and wind today. I can't bring myself to chase it away, so maybe I'm not as tough a gardener as I thought. I would, however, like to put in some raspberries this spring. I assume spring's the time to put in raspberries. And I've got lots of catalogs, but I haven't the faintest idea what to choose. So I need maybe Raspberry 101.
Raspberry 101. I grow the ever-bearing raspberries because my husband loves raspberries. And having just one crop a year isn't ideal for us.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you grow the ever-bearing, which means that they're going to have one small crop and then a larger crop. They bear on the newer canes as well as the older canes' side branches each year. You're still not going to have much until next year, so don't get your mouth watering too much. I'm particularly fond of the golden raspberries that are out right now. They're wonderful plants. And then I just have plain old September and Latham, which have been around for, what are those, Sandy? Those have got to be 1920. Yeah, those are old, old varieties, but they're reliable. You buy them from a good source that ships virus-free stock, and you'll find that note in your catalog that they're doing that. Put them in good sun with good soil, and 20 years later, you may still have raspberries in that same spot. It's not ideal to keep them for all of 20 years in the same spot. So I would pick a standard one that's been around for quite a while, a nice red one, and then maybe one that's a different kind. But do think about that ever-bearing, and you'll see that description in there, that where you're going to get a crop in the summer as well as the crop in the early fall, so that you don't have to wait too long to taste what you've planted.
And Heritage is actually a really good one for us, for one ever-berries. So that's really nice one, usually easy to find. And I'm with Janet. Boy, the yellow ones, and those are ones that they don't travel very well. So they're one of those that, you know, unless you grow it in your backyard or your neighbor grows in the backyard, you generally don't get them because they tend to kind of fall apart a little bit more. So you generally don't see them for sale here and there. But they're so tasty and so sweet and just really kind of a nice treat. So I think the fall gold and some of the yellow ones are nice. And I should let you know that actually the U of I Extension has a wonderful book on growing small fruits in the home garden. And it's $5, and it's just a really nice little book, but it talks about all things like, you know, different varieties, certainly of raspberries and blackberries, but also strawberries and blueberries and all the smaller fruits. So it's really kind of a nice reference to have. So if you're really going to get into this, you might think about that too.
And you're already a gardener, so probably you won't need to hear this, but especially with raspberries, make sure the bed is clean of perennial weeds before you plant them. Because it's not going to be easy to get things out from in between raspberries. Yeah, so if it's a bed that's got a lot of quackgrass or whatever in it, one of those weeds that doesn't kill easily, do think about digging them out and making sure that you've got all the roots out, and certainly don't put it where you've got bindweed or those that take a couple years to kill back.
All right, any advice then on taking out bindweed? Because that definitely is a problem.
I just tell people marry it and go into counseling together with it because it's going to be a while. I dig what I can of bindweed. I dig and reach all of the roots that I can, and then I put a heavy layer of newspaper and mulch on that area, and everything green that shows its head from there I nip off as soon as it appears. it usually takes 2 years, sometimes three, before you can say, I think this is clean enough for those kinds of things. It's not an easy weed. It's a native, and it's a toughie, and the natives called it man underground.
Yeah, no
kidding. The storage root can be as big as a leg and can be buried as deep as a man might be buried. So, that takes a lot of years to exhaust that. So I don't offer a lot of hope to people. I tell them, go ahead, go into counseling together. Just don't marry somebody like I did in my husband's family. We were trying to get it out of Grandma Jenny's garden, and Grandma Jenny, without fail, despite our telling her that every week, Grandma, I want you to go out there and anything green you see there, just cut it off. That's what you got to do, is cut it off so it doesn't recharge the root. She would still invariably call at some point during the summer and say, Janet, I just love these flowers that you planted out here. They're so gorgeous. And I would say, tell me about it. And she'd start telling me about the little trumpet white flowers. And I'd go, oh, my gosh.
Does Roundup work on it?
Only it works as well as cutting it off repeatedly.
Okay.
The Roundup can only work as well as how much of it the leaf can metabolize and take to the root. And when you think that you're spraying 10 leaves above ground,
yeah,
but you've got a root big enough to produce 1,000 leaves, it's going to take a number of applications over a long period of time.
Right, I can persevere. That's not a problem. All right, my last raspberry question then has to do with suckering, and I've seen a lot of plants where people will put in pipes and wire to kind of keep the raspberries from straggling. And am I going to end up with raspberries kind of creeping across the path into the prairie?
Yes.
There some that don't suck?
Yes. They move. Raspberries move. And really, they need to move. You can let them move, and then you can cut them out where they were and put the path next to them, and you've got a renewed plants that way.
Yeah, the person who's with me in the marriage counseling will not be happy about that.
I can't offer you much anything there. I know that an English gardener that I worked with for a summer put flashing that you use when you're doing roofing, you put that into the ground as a vertical barrier against the spread, the same way that he would in front of a hedge to keep the hedge from competing with plants in front.
Sure.
But that means that your raspberries are going to be more dependent on a smaller piece of ground, and you'd better put a drip hose and make sure that they're well-fertilized within the area you've confined them.
Okay, that makes sense. So I ought essentially to take what the garden catalogs say with a grain of salt about ones that aren't going to sucker?
Well, some of them don't sucker as much. I mean, some of the hybrids, even the gold ones, I don't notice moving as much, but they do move.
Oh, okay. So it's more of a rate rather than don't.
I think that's right.
Yeah, whether they're moving like they're being chased or whether they're moving slowly, yes, that's it.
Okay, good. Well, I'm ready now. Just need a little warm weather.
All right. Well, good luck with that. Thanks for the call. I just wanted to make sure I understand that the raspberry that you're talking about, the golden raspberry, the fruit is actually yellow. I have never seen such a thing. But I guess Sandy was saying that's. It sounds like the only way you're really going to see it is if you grow it yourself, or your next door neighbor does.
Right.
Or you have a local grower that has a pick your own patch of the yellows. Yeah. Oh, they're beautiful. Yeah. They're not butter yellow. They're gold. They're gold.
Okay, maybe that's why they call it that. Yeah, okay. We're talking here this morning about lawn and garden care, how to take care of things that grow in the home landscape. We do that every month. It's always on a Tuesday with Sandy Mason. She's horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. She's generally here in the studio, but because of the weather, she's at her house. She's joining us by phone. Also, as a special guest, Janet Konovich. She is well known for writing about and teaching about landscape and garden design. She has given programs and talked all over the country. She has the bio before I had must have been slightly behind the times. I'm now looking at the one at the website for Practical Gardening Institute, and actually it's 9 books. She has authored 9 that should be available here throughout the United States. She had, for a number of years, wrote a weekly newspaper column, Growing Concerns, in the Detroit News, and that moved in 2005 online to the Practical Gardening Institute. So if you'd like to take a look at that and the kinds of things that are available there, go to practicalgardeninginstitute.com and you can find out more about it. And she will be one one of the featured speakers at the Garden Day for 2007, sponsored by U of I Extension and also the Champaign County Master Gardeners, and that's March 2nd and 3rd at the Holiday Inn in Urbana. And you can go to the Extension website and get more information on that. And we are full up here with callers, so we'll just keep on giving folks a chance to talk with Sandy and Janet. The number, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk next with someone in Normal, and that's line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Two years ago, I bought some grapes to plant, and I wanted them to grow over my pergola to, and so I've just been letting them grow. And I bought that book that you suggested to the previous caller about the small fruits, because at your suggestion, and I was reading through it, and it said that the first year I should have been pruning it back. Should I be pruning that back if I want it to grow over the, you know, the pergola?
I'm sorry that the very first part, what kind of vine you said they are, I didn't
hear.
They
are grapes.
Grapes?
Yes,
well,
grapes.
It's better to form a structure because over the years when you grow grapes, if you're growing them for fruit, you're going to get a better crop if you can prune them back regularly to main stems that you established to begin with. So the first year you do let them, you train them in the direction and the number of canes that you want to grow, and then you each year let branches grow from those canes and then cut them back again. You do need to get them up to a pergola, though. So usually the first year, if you're growing them up to go over something, then the first year your pruning consists of taking side branches off to encourage just the growth at the top to get to the top. So you may not be behind by very much.
Okay.
Is this pergola over a patio?
Yes.
Do you really want a lot of grapes then? I mean, do you want a big production of grapes?
Well, I'm using it for shade and for production, yes.
Yeah, if you're using it mostly for shade as opposed to mostly for grapes, you're still going to get grapes if you just let it grow.
Uh-huh.
and let it give you the shade that a fast-growing grapevine can give you. But if you want it to look like those pictures in the catalogs of those villas in France and Italy where they have these spectacular bunches of grapes hanging down between every side, every cross piece on the pergola, then when that grapevine gets to the top, select one each branch to go across the pergola on one of your main support pieces and start cutting side branches off that go every which way, so that you start getting thicker and thicker stems that are just paralleling your main supports. And then every year they'll grow side branches from there, and your grapes will form in kind of a formation across the pergola and give you that pretty look.
Okay.
And as I tell people, there's a reason why you see all those grapevine wreaths all over the place. You really have to do quite a bit of pruning each year once they get going in order to get good production. So as Janet said, it kind of depends on how much production you really want, but you do end up doing a lot of pruning as they grow.
So a lot of pruning for good production.
Right. So usually we're talking about February, obviously not right now, but usually end of February, 1st of March is a good time before they really start budding out.
To do your pruning. Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
We'll go right over to somebody else here back in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I just have a quick question about my coral bells. Can I divide those?
Oh, you pretty much need to divide them. Coral bells in a garden, if they're not divided regularly, will get pretty woody and start declining in the third year, the fourth year. So, yeah, pick them up and break them into pieces. They don't even need very many side roots. It's a little bit like geraniums. They've got a thickened, woody stem-type cluster where all of the leaves come together. As long as that's well into the ground, and I do it usually as early in April as I can work the soil and set them out. Yeah, you can make 20 pieces out of one coral bell, and you won't know at the end of the year that there wasn't 20 big new coral bells you bought.
Oh, that's great, because I haven't been able to find any more of this color.
And that's what I do. They, you know, coral bells anymore are like the hostas, where they've, there are so many kinds that they keep discontinuing. I have one called Cathedral Windows that I just love and can't find anywhere. And so that's what I do, is I go back to the garden where I planted it and say, guess what, Virginia? I'm here to divide your coral bells again. Yeah.
Well, as long as I've got you on the line, when should I transplant my grape? I don't want it anymore, and my neighbor does.
I'd do it in the spring, as soon as you can, really around April 1st or so is a good time to do that.
Okay, great. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you. Then we'll go to line number two, and this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I have actually a couple of questions, but the first one, since we haven't had some weather like this in a little while, I was wondering if... Your guest today could talk about projected effect of this weather on especially the pest population. And I'm thinking about how, particularly later on in the summer, the Japanese beetle population was getting larger and larger. I was wondering if we could look forward to possible reduction in that. And then also, I was actually encouraged to hear discussion about digging weeds out, because I'm very committed to non-polluting, pest and weed control in the garden. And it seems that no matter what, I keep coming back to mechanical means, you know, getting out there with a dandelion digger. And, in fact, I even read that Roundup can be damaging to frog populations. So I was wondering if that's still true, if getting a shovel out and getting the digger out is really the safest way to control unwanted color in the garden in the form of...
Unwanted color, what a great term. I think so. I don't use herbicides. I do know how to use herbicides. I work with people who use herbicides. Some of my clients do that. But what I have seen is that the amount of time that I spend cleaning a garden by digging, I can make a bed more quickly by digging the weeds out in terms of elapsed time than if I use a herbicide and then wait for weeds to die. I don't like to use herbicides. I started out not using herbicides specifically because of the frog and toad impact in my own yard. I have my property, I'm in a subdivision, but it once upon a time was a wetland. And in putting in some rain gardens and bog gardens, I immediately got frogs and toads. They are severely affected by, most of the amphibians are, by herbicides. I work at our Detroit Zoo as an adopt-a-gardener and have for the last 19 years, and our curator of the amphibians and the turtles outside is just all with us on using as little of that as we can. But mm-hmm. for me, it's not just because of the frogs and toads. In my own choices, in working in clients' gardens, I've found that physically we can do that. Now, if you've got a whole field to do, as my friends the Donies who run a wildflower farm do, they say, you know, Janet, you can't dig a whole field clean to get a whole good clean planting put in. When you're working on a larger scale, it is something that we couldn't do the things we do and sell the things we sell without them. So we have to find some kind of medium, I guess, between the whole bunch of us.
But I think another thing that actually has been pretty successful for me is just smothering things out. I actually had a bed that was just being overtaken, a strawberry bed just being overtaken with Creeping Charlie, and I just couldn't, you know, it was just too hard. I was trying to dig it out, that digging out the strawberries and all that, and I just decided I needed to renovate the strawberries anyway. So I just buried it, put the wet newspaper over it, and kind of did the lasagna gardening technique. I just started layering with peat moss and compost and grass clippings until I had about four or five different layers of stuff on top of it. And amazingly enough, actually even the Creeping Charlie killed it off.
So it's a good way to go. Yep, no, smothering's a good way to go. You just have to wait until whatever is under there is dead, and so
right,
it takes a
right.
little. But yeah, we smother, especially under trees. I can't dig under trees. I can use a fork to loosen and take tree roots out. But if I've got a bed that someone says, you know, it is just running loose with bishop's weed, snow on the mountain, mm-hmm. goutweed, bishop's weed, we can't get that all out of the roots, but we can smother that. By next year, it's a clean bed to plant in. But as for effects of the weather, I know I've been looking recently at and hoping, because it has now been colder here in my part of Michigan than we've had in at least 10 years. 95, 96, we had a snap that took us down to 22 below. But we've had mimosa webworm, which does not belong in our area, but it's been in our locust trees, and
It's not going to kill them, but it makes them look awful, defoliates them in August. And it's possible that this cold will kill off the mimosa webworms where they're overwintering in the leaf duffs, and I'd like to see that happen. I doubt very much that it's going to kill the Japanese beetles. They can manage Minnesota winters, so I don't think that there's going to be much effect there.
And I think the biggest problem is, the thing to keep in mind, it probably affects those insects, as you were saying, like the mimosa webworm, things that overwinter above ground.
Uh-huh.
Those are the ones that are going to be much more susceptible to being killed off by cold temperatures. So things like, certainly for us, bagworms would be one that we might see less. And actually a lot of our, like, fall webworm and a lot of those that overwinter above ground. But, you know, Japanese beetles, unfortunately, they're overwintering as grubs under the soil, pretty darn protected, and certainly if they can tolerate it clear up to Minnesota, then what cold weather we get here, I doubt. I wish that was the case.
Wouldn't it be great, yep. Except that we'd lose a lot of good things that way, too. We'd lose click beetles and all the other things in the soil. But I dig a hole in a couple of my clients' gardens where we want to keep tender things. I just dig a hole 18 inches deep, and I bury cannas, dahlias, the rose tree, and there they are 18 inches underground, and they're staying 50 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
I love your extension, Sandy. You post the soil temperatures. There they are. I can go and look at them. We don't have that for whatever reason, that we don't post that on the Michigan extension, and I love to look at that and go, look at that. It's 50 degrees down there. They're summering over down there, just below the surface.
Well, I appreciate the comments and the encouragement to, for healthier gardening. So thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, just real quick, Janet, I'm real interested in what you had to say. I haven't done this in a while, but I have from time to time grown cannas and had problems with them. Sometimes, you know, you dig them up and you bring them inside, and sometimes them not surviving. If I was willing to, and here, I don't know what our subsoil temperatures are. I'm sure they're not quite as cold as they would be where you are. If you're willing to dig a hole and put the cannas down in them, you can actually do it that way?
Oh, yeah, I've done that for years. Matter of fact, that's an old farm technique. I mean, you dug a pit, and you put your carrots and potatoes and things, that root cellar kinds of things that you didn't have room for in the root cellar, and put them in, and then just make it so you can dig them up. I wrap them up in a piece of burlap so I can find them, tie a rope to the end of the burlap, put them in the bottom of the hole, and bury them. And then I just find the rope in the spring and dig up around them, and very rarely do we lose things. They stay more moist that way, because inside we lose most of them because it gets a little out, they wrinkle, the fungus gets them, and plus they take up the room inside the house. So, it's worked really well for us, and they're beautiful. They come out looking like you just put them in. Makes you feel good when you bring them up.
Well, that's a great technique. I like that. I don't think that I've ever heard anybody suggest doing that before, and it seems like that wouldn't be, you know, if you're willing to dig the hole, depending on how many you've got, that sounds like that would be a much better way to go than try to get them through the winter in the basement, even if you have a good, cool basement.
Yeah, and if you didn't want to dig the hole every year, I do have a friend who just buried a garbage can with, put some holes in the bottom so in case water got into it. He just buried a plastic garbage tub, and every year he puts all his old potting mix from the containers. So he puts the bulbs in, throws all the potting mix in from the containers, so that puts the lid on the container, throws soil on top of that, and he's got a hole dug every year, essentially.
Well, that's a beauty deal.
I like that idea.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot.
I really like that idea.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's go talk to somebody else here. This is next caller is in Urbana, and it's line 3. Hello.
Hello. I have a couple questions. The first is easy, I hope. I have peonies that are being overrun by raspberries, and I like both. And my intentions were to transplant the peonies and separate them and make a few more bushes in September, but of course I didn't get to it. Can I do that in the spring, or is it really preferable to move peonies only in the fall? Because I kind of like the raspberries too, but they're moving, as you've described. So that's my first question.
Okay, one of my heroes in gardening, who sadly has passed away now, is Christopher Lloyd from England. And one of his sayings was, the time to do something in the garden is when you think of it. Don't go by their schedules, go by yours. I've moved peonies in every month of the year, including in 2002. I moved some in January just because it was thawed out there, so we went and did it. In the fall, the roots are hardened. They're not so easily broken, and the plant is got a better chance, more time to settle in before it starts top growth. So it's the best time to move them in the early fall. But
But I've moved them in the spring, and I've had no problems with them. It's one of those things that you want to look at any plant you move and say, well, I just moved it at kind of a bad time, so I'm going to make sure that I give enough water, et cetera. Start digging wide out where the branches of the peony reached, so at its full extension. Start digging out there. Scrape the soil away until you find the roots. So you're digging a trench all the way around the peony, which, of course, with your raspberries in there is going to cut through some raspberry roots too, and then just peel soil down away from the peony roots into the deeper trench, and you'll be able to lift the thing without hardly breaking any roots. It's amazing how much you can get of it. Then while you have it up, clean off the parts that don't look good, because the peony botrytis, which kills the buds and leaves them as little tiny black-brown unopened pieces, will get into the stem, and you'll find decayed parts in the stem. And cut those out. Use a little bit of 10% Clorox and water to clean that out, because when you move them, they're under a little bit of stress, and sometimes fungus can get the upper hand, and you have more of it that year.
So you're actually moving them but not dividing them in the spring?
I want to divide them.
No, I mean, I guess I was asking Janet if she's actually ever divided them in the spring.
Yeah, I've divided them in the spring too. In fact, I did. And still, now I didn't. In the ones that I divided in the spring, I didn't get bloom, but that wasn't necessarily because of the potential. It was because I divided them into very small pieces and cut out a lot of botrytis infected eyes, but. There isn't any reason that you shouldn't get bloom if you divide a large enough piece. It's just a matter of when's best, and these numbers and recommendations are made in many cases by the growers, the professional growers, who certainly know that they get a better take when they do it at a certain time of year, but they're also looking at if they lose 2% of the crop, it makes a difference to them. If you don't mind trying it, go for it and divide them. I divided a yellow intersectional peony last year in July, not because I really wanted to, but because somebody was adding onto the house. And as long as I had it out of the ground, I took a piece out of it and set it aside someplace else, because this is one of those peonies that cost, you know, several hundred dollars when they first bought it, and I want to increase my chances, so I put two pieces out there. But I haven't had any problems with them except moving them when they're in bloom. When you move them when they're in bloom, they look rattled. There's no getting around that, even if you put stakes in before you move.
Okay, thank you. That's all good advice. The other question I have is, when we moved into our home, I didn't realize the signs, and I didn't know what it was. We got a bad infestation of a thing called Easter grass, which is not really a grass. It's these bulbs. It's also called wild garlic, I think, and they're horrible, and they multiply. And I have this, like, 20-foot by 15-foot section that's heavily shaded, so everything else has kind of fallen away. And this thing blooms and grows and is awful, and then it fades away, and then there's, like, ground, mud, just kind of there. And I'm wondering, how can I get rid of it? Do I just need to scrape away the top 3 inches, because these bulbs for each little bunch of Easter grass, you know, I've got like 50 bulbs there. It's horrible.
They are horrible. They're also called ramps. And there's a book by Edwin Rollins Spencer that was out of print and brought back into print again. I'm always glad when they do that. He's a farmer and a retired extension agent who was writing kind of like I talk about the peonies, for instance. It's not best to divide them in the spring. It's just the practicalities sometimes say you do. Well, in the case of ramps or wild onions or wild garlic, he said you turn out the hogs without the rings in their noses to clean them out. In other words, dig them. And I never knew until I read that. I said, well, for crying out loud, is that why they put rings in hogs' noses, so that they can't dig so well? But you do have to dig them out. And then you have to recognize that you've already seen it. You're going to miss some of the bulbs, the little tiny ones. You're going to have to do it for more than 1 year. So don't go planting something else there right away. Leave that as a heavily smothered area during their growing season, which is real early. They're up now, aren't they?
Well, we've got several inches of snow, but they'll be up soon. So just cover it with tarps and lots of organic matter, or what? I mean, this is—it's a really bad problem in my house, or I mean, in my yard.
if you're just going to smother them, you're going to have to smother them for more than 1 year. That's a lot of energy stored in that bulb. So I would dig them and then smother the area.
Yeah.
Get out as
okay.
much as you can.
Get out the biggest ones for sure and then go from there.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I did, like, there was one area that I just couldn't stand it being so bare, and so I dug out the topsoil and replaced it with soil from bags. I mean, I went down several inches, so hopefully I got it, and then I planted some lovely plants, but shade plants. But I still have just a huge surrounding area. But, okay, I have to do it mechanically. I was hoping there was something that might work other than that.
You don't have a friend with a potbelly pig that will loan them to you.
Develop it.
Wouldn't that be nice? Well, thank you for all your
right.
advice.
Thanks for calling. There are, people do eat them,
sure.
right? Yes?
Oh, that would be one option.
You can start a little ramp stand down at the farmer's market.
There you go.
All right. Let's see. We have at least one more caller here. Somebody in Mattoon, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I had a question on blossom rot on tomatoes. I had a real problem with that last year and sprayed a little bit, and I think it cut down on my crop. And I just wondered, in planting tomatoes, should you throw a little calcium with it when you plant it, or is there anything you can do that to deter it? And apparently, we had blossom rot in this community, too, for a number of places.
Yeah, the biggest thing with blossom rot has more to do with our weather than anything, and it's not so much that there isn't calcium in the soil, it's just because we get these really hot, humid days, and then the plant actually needs to transpire, actually needs to lose water vapor in order to bring up actually the calcium through the soil. And we don't, unfortunately, when it gets hot and humid, they don't do that, and so we get this calcium deficiency. And so it's not that it's not in the soil, it's just it's not in the plant. And so probably one of the big things is don't, you know, really try to moderate how much watering they get. In other words, don't let them go real wet and then real dry and real wet. So mulching is good. It tends to be worse in those plants that have been staked as opposed to caged. In other words, if you're doing a lot of pruning on them, then it tends to be worse. It tends to be worse in some varieties, so you may want to make sure you try a different variety next time. Sometimes that's the case. But unfortunately, in our area, a lot of it has to do with just the weather. When we get these really, really humid days, it's really an issue. And unfortunately, and, you know, it's one of those things you can still eat the tomato. You can just, you know, you can't can it or anything like that, but you can certainly still eat it, just cut out that bad part. And then usually the weather just changes to the point where you don't end up having it.
One other question. I like to plant lettuce and spinach real early, sometime in, you know, early March and as soon as I can. And sometimes the soil is really moist and not easy to work with, and someone said use some of that topsoil you get from farm stores and just put that topsoil on there and cover it up. I really don't know the value of that commercial product. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think if you really try, I guess a couple things is that, you know, obviously you don't want to work the soil when it's too wet, but if you have halfway decent soil and, you know, you've been working that area and it's halfway decent, there really isn't a big issue, you really don't necessarily have to till every year. So you may find just, you know, basically broadcasting because all that seed's pretty much on the top. And then if you want to top dress it with topsoil, or sometimes I just use old potting mix, you know, stuff that I've had in the house, and I just use old potting mix on top of something. So you don't necessarily have to use the topsoil that you buy in the bags. You can certainly use, you know, even compost maybe that you have, just something so you can top dress it. And a lot of times it works out just fine. You really don't have to till. You really don't have to do really a lot of the work that we think we do sometimes.
So when you plant later on, it would be better not to put that topsoil down in the hole when you're putting the plants in?
Unless usually you have what you need right there with compost or just any of the soil that's around is fine. So you don't necessarily have to have topsoil unless you really feel like your soil is just lousy. And in that case, I'd probably really be thinking about adding more compost and really trying to change the soil that's there rather than purchasing things. So, you know, that's really kind of up to you, but you really don't necessarily have to do that. Sometimes I've done that because the soil is just so wet, and I feel like, you know, it's that timing, I just need to do it, I need to get the peas out or whatever it is, that I do go ahead and use potting mix or topsoil just because it's drier and it's something I can use and because the soil that I have is just too wet.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, we lost Janet for a second here, but I think we have her back on one of our calls. Are you there, Janet?
I am.
Oh,
I am. Sorry.
sorry. I don't know what happened.
Well, sometimes, you know, with this high technology we got here, sometimes things don't work as well as they should. Anyway.
I'm really glad, though, actually. I talk too much, and I'm real interested in the you've noticed that the staked tomatoes tend to have a little more tendency than caged tomatoes toward the blossom end blight. Is that what was the discussion was about, Sandy?
Right, right.
That's really good to hear. I've been... it's so annoying.
It is annoying. We tend to have a lot of it here. I don't know if you folks.
We
have
do too. Well, we get those. You get those spells that go dry. I put bottles of water turned upside down to like just drip. I jam them into the ground so the neck is in the ground and they're just oozing water out a little bit at a time to try to even out the water. But still, you get some every year, and it's always when you just wanted some nice tomatoes, and there they are.
You know, and I always hear that, you know, there's some varieties that is worse than others. Have you ever seen a list that actually lists?
No, I was waiting.
I hear that all the time, and I tend to repeat that, but it seems like it's just personal, you know, experience.
Yeah, I have not seen a list, no,
yeah,
and that's, isn't it sad that if there was, they just wouldn't sell, you know, because
right, maybe.
Well, it seems, though, that an important piece of advice, and Sandy, you gave, and I know we've gotten these kind of calls before, is you have to be consistent about your watering. You can't just drown the plant. You can't look at the plant and say, oh, it hasn't rained, and it's really dry, so I'm going to water it really well, and then let it dry out and go another week and do that again, because then what you're doing there, it's possible that you might actually be giving the plant in total the amount of water that you think it should have. But if you do it that way, you go wet, dry, wet, dry, wet, dry. That's what you're really doing, is you're actually fostering the conditions for the end rot to occur. And it would be easy enough to do with a little work to do something like Janet suggested, or, you know, if you're going to water, well, okay, but you're going to have to, you can't let it go dry. And then
I'm just trying to mulch and some of those things so that you do keep this even watering.
Yeah. Well, we're pretty much at the point here where we're going to have to stop. I just want to say one more time for people who are here where we are in and around Champaign County. Garden Day 2007 is coming up March 2nd and 3rd, sponsored by U of I Extension and the Champaign County Master Gardeners. And there will be a number of things going on. And Janet Mikonovich, who has been joining us here on the telephone, will be one of the featured speakers. And Sandy, again, how do people get involved in this?
Well, they can go to our website, and it's just champaign.extension.uiuc.edu, or they can give us a call at 217-333-7672. And if I just have just a moment, I just want to say something quick about Janet. This is actually the third time she's come to talk to us, and we keep asking her back because she's just so good. And I'm not just saying that because she's on the phone, but I think what people probably found out just from the morning show here is that she does this kind of stuff. She's not just talking about it. She does it. She learns from it. And she has such a great way of explaining it so that we all, and I always learn things from her. So I think people are really going to enjoy her talk. So
well, we got to go. Sandy, thank you very much.
Sure.
And Janet, thank you very much.
Thank you.